Good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then we consider what you know of the news of the day. Now tonight we take a look at the latest in the ongoing battle to have children who are born abroad to Malaysian mothers recognised as citizens of our country. Now this battle continues despite last September's landmark ruling by the High Court, which declared that Malaysian women and men are supposed to have equal rights to confer citizenship on their overseas born children. Now the government is appealing this ruling, this High Court ruling, and the Court of Appeal has now set August 5th as the new date to deliver its decision. Joining us now is Suri Kampa. She's the president of the NGO Family Frontiers. Suri, you're one of the plaintiffs in this case. Maybe you can begin our conversation tonight by helping us understand the latest development, the latest legal developments. I mean, we understand that the government has raised an additional point for the bench to consider before making its decision. The Attorney General's chambers claim that the 2001 constitutional amendment to stop gender discrimination in Malaysia is invalid. Can you explain, help the public understand this argument?
Correct. So just a quick recap. As you mentioned earlier, the government wrote in beforehand to say, wait, there's another recent judgment by the federal court that affects this case, and namely, it's the Dinesh Tanapil versus Lembaga Pencegahan Jenayah and two others. And so the Court of Appeal judges then, of course, said, okay, well, let's hear both sides of the argument, but that means we won't be able to issue our decision on the 22nd of June. And so last week, the government then argued that their understanding of this recent federal court decision was that it said that no amendments could be made to the federal constitution ever, because any amendment would change the basic structure of the federal constitution, even an amendment to improve the federal constitution. So according to the senior federal counsel that day, what this means is that you cannot amend the federal constitution to allow for gender discrimination to be declared unconstitutional, and that the amendment in 2001 was then therefore impermissible. And he took it one step further to argue that this had implication on the court's jurisdiction. He said that if Parliament can't amend the federal constitution, then the courts shouldn't either. And so then,
correct. Wow, okay, all right. So
it's mind-blowing.
So precisely that, how are you digesting this? How are you interpreting this? How are your lawyers interpreting this argument?
I'm glad you're asking this question. So essentially, our legal team, our side, argued that the government was misinterpreting the judgment by focusing narrowly on three paragraphs plucked out of a 120-page judgment. Our counter was that when you read the entire judgment holistically, it says that amendments are possible as long as those amendments are not inconsistent with the basic structure and the fundamental provisions of the Constitution. So when you want to enhance a right or improve the provisions of the Constitution and amplify rights, then you are perfectly entitled to do that. So for example, in the way that the amendment on gender in 2001 enhanced the Constitution's scope on anti-discrimination, that was perfectly allowable and within the right of Parliament to do so. And so really, you know, our big takeaway, at least my big takeaway from this, is that there just seems to be a lot of mental acrobatics, or just a lot of work and effort is being put into keeping Malaysian women from being equal to Malaysian men. As you know, are Malaysian women and their children really that much of a threat to Malaysia that you would, rely on such an argument, right?
Well, I do want to ask you that, Suri, because I've been trying to understand the why behind it. I'm trying to understand what possible reason to deny automatic citizenship. What is at the root of the government's resistance? I mean, I'm wondering, where is the trade-off? What is the trade-off in denying women this right?
I think that's a really good question. And I think this question should really be asked to the government, right? Because to be honest, I have no clue. I have no answer.
What would you posit as perhaps the reason for this?
I mean, they've kept saying that, you know, this is their standard response in Parliament, that if we grant Malaysian women equal right to confer citizenship, that this will threaten, be a national threat to Malaysia's national security. That Malaysia does not grant the right to confer, to have or carry dual citizenship. But I think this argument is really moot because there are plenty of women are not the source of dual citizenship. You know, women giving birth abroad is not the source of dual citizenship. Dual citizenship can be received multiple other ways, you know. So if both parents are Malaysian and they happen to give birth to that child in a country that confers citizenship on the basis of jus soli, meaning as long as that child is born in that country, like in the United States, for example, then that child will receive US citizenship, right? So that's just another example of a way a child can get dual citizenship. And the point of which is to say that, you know, if we have an issue with dual citizenship, that's all fine and well. But the key to solving this problem is not by denying women the equal right to confer citizenship to their children. So that's just my quick take on it, right? Like, just a way to solve the issue of dual citizenship and Malaysian women and their children, simply because those children are born abroad, are not a threat to Malaysia's security.
Can I ask you, Suri, how many Malaysian families have been affected by these discriminatory laws? The reason I ask is because there seems to be this perception and misconception that, you know, this is an issue that only affects women of a certain social strata, women who have worked or studied abroad, who've married non-Malaysian men. How would you respond to that in terms of the impact of this discriminatory law towards this? What is the scale of the impact?
That's also a good question. And the thing is, we don't really have an accurate figure. We know that it is in the thousands. We know simply by the number of people who contact Family Frontiers, but we also know that, you know, there are plenty of people who don't connect with us, right? We know, for example, but all of us seem to know someone who is affected. And so we know that it reaches the thousands, and the proxy number, we've used a proxy number, and that is the number of applications that the government gets for citizenship applications under Article 15.2, right? That is citizenship by registration. And that number has always, right, currently numbers in the thousands. It's difficult to get an accurate read from government responses because in Parliament, you know, the number that they cite differs in terms of the bracket, like the years that they count. Mm-hmm. But it always numbers in the thousands, and we know that approvals are absolutely difficult to get. One is we don't get a reason for the rejection. And two, the reason for that rejection is never clarified. But also we know that it's really, really difficult because if you look at the latest statistics that the government presented in a response in Parliament, was that the number of approvals last year was zero. It was zero, right? So the number of citizenship applications that were approved under Article 15.2 in 2021 was zero. And if you just counted on like that statistic alone, the approval rate last year was zero, which means that and in the previous years, it hadn't changed much. It was anywhere between 1% to 3% approvals, right?
How long does it take? I mean, there are some success stories, but how long would it take to get an approval? Typically,
that can range. Again, that's like one of those illusory things that no one can really answer because it can take anywhere from, you know, 2 years or 3 years, which is probably something that can be considered relative. That's really quick. 2 to 3 years is relatively quick. But 5 years is the average to receive your first rejection. Because just because you put in an application does not mean that the application will be approved, right? So then they say, okay, 5 years has passed. Say, for example, the child is 6 months old and you put in an application when that child is, you know, even newly born. It takes you 5 years for that first rejection letter. And then they say, well, you can always try again and submit, restart the application process all the way from the beginning. And then that takes another 5 to 6 years to get maybe. Sometimes you get it and sometimes it's like some people have been rejected. A lot of mothers we know, for example, in our network have been rejected up to 4 or 5 times, right? 4 times. The point which is, right? The point of which is that at the age of 21, the children age out and they can no longer apply under this provision in the Constitution. So at the age of 21, suddenly all your applications rejected. You know, don't count for anything.
You know, I think for many of us watching, when we say things like, you know, 2 years and 3 years and 5 years for the process, we often forget that this is years in a child's life. This is years of a child being deprived of their citizenship and their rights and their papers and their documents. What have you seen, Suri, that how does that deprivation impact a child born overseas to a Malaysian mother who does not have her citizenship?
So a lot of times, I mean, the biggest one, the most glaring one is always in the area of education and healthcare, which is so crucial, especially in the developing years of a child, right? Especially in the early ages of a child. Education and healthcare are huge, especially for children who are more vulnerable. So for example, if they have a disability, they have a chronic illness, which requires consistent treatment, right? A lot of mothers just don't have the finances available to be able to pay for that care, healthcare, or even education, private education, consistently, right? Especially if you have more than one child, for example, right? If a child needs special education, and they're unable to access that, that becomes really, really difficult. We have a mother, for example, who has two children who fall on the on the autism spectrum, right? And she's had to choose therapy for one child because she cannot afford therapy for both. So that is one of those big things, the glaring gaps, you know, and which is terrible. Of course, there's also this idea, you know, that the assumption under that discrimination is also that the child will always be able to access the father's citizenship. But that's not always the case because there is a huge risk of statelessness if that child cannot access the foreign father's citizenship. So, for example, if they're born in a third country, which doesn't allow it, or the father is a refugee or the father is stateless, you know. So we have mothers who have married Syrian refugees or Palestinian refugees, and they're just unable to get the father's citizenship. And of course, you know, there's when the child hits 21, as I mentioned earlier, and they can't rely on that provision anymore, there's this constant fear of separation. Imagine if they grow up here and this is the only family they know, then, you know, there's this at 21, what are you going to do, right? And a lot of families, if they have the money, then, you know, often try and make sure that the child, for example, even if the child has a degree, then they enroll the child in another, like, oh, just do a diploma quickly so you can stay here on a student visa. But that's if you have the money, that might be a possibility. But otherwise, you know, those children cannot stay in the country with their families. Of course, and then there's also loss of opportunities. You know, you can't, even if the child is good in school, you can't access scholarships, sponsorships, loans for tertiary education become really difficult. And all of this compounds on itself. And then, you know, there's then the factor of like psychosocial distress, right? There's a lot of anxiety, social exclusion, especially when this child is part of and has other siblings. And this is the only child that's not a Malaysian and the rest of the children are, right? So we have one child, when the High Court decision came out, one child was like, now I can be Malaysian just like mommy and my sister, right? And it was just so sad. How do you tell a child, and this child is constantly being excluded, like we cannot travel to, like, you know, you have to go in the foreign passport lane if you have a passport, otherwise you just can't leave the country while you know, mommy and the rest of the siblings, the rest of the family can. So I mean, that has a huge impact on a child's psychology and mental health and their development. And, you know, of course I'm talking about the children, not even the mothers.
The impact is real on Malaysian families, for sure. Suri, I'm going to circle back to the court case. Now, I'm just wondering, because the verdict for the government's appeal has been deferred to August 5th, would you consider that an encouraging sign that there is a new date now? I mean, we were expecting 22nd of June, now it's August 5th. Is that an encouraging sign?
I think so. I would say yes, because even when they were trying to determine a date, the Court of Appeal judges kindly were like, you know, let's find a date soon and do this as quickly as possible so that we can announce something, because this is a public interest case, you know, and thousands of women are affected by the delays, right? And they need to know. So yes, absolutely. I think it's a positive sign. I think we're grateful that they're trying to expedite the issuance of the decision as fast as possible. So yes.
So I know this is a case for the judiciary, but is there anything the public can do between now and August 5th? I know you've got several campaigns. You've got the Saya Juga Nak Malaysia campaign. You've got the Mana Dokumen Kami campaign. Is there anything that Malaysians can do to show solidarity and support for the need for equality in our citizenship laws?
Absolutely. You know, the public support has really been key to unlocking this right for Malaysian mothers, and is a signal that, you know, the public does support, there's huge support for Malaysian mothers and Malaysian women. And I think it's really important for the public to continue voicing their support, whether that's on social media or at dinner conversations, and where possible, of course, I would say tag your MP, tag the relevant ministers, tag the ministries to say that this is something that is important to you, and you want to see it done, right? We also know that elections are coming, so engage your MPs in a conversation about this. Vote for representatives that really walk the talk and care about Malaysian women, right? We are, women at the end of the day are half the electorate, and we are tired of being treated like we are not equal to men. We are tired of having our children excluded. We are tired of being told that our children are a threat to national security. It is heartbreaking that the country we love so much does not seem to want us or our children, right? So yes, and of course, if you're an impacted mother, share your story. I think they're really powerful because people don't realize the extent to which it impacts the Malaysian family, you know, all of which is to say that these discriminatory policies really end up fracturing the Malaysian family, and it needs to end.
Suri Kampa, president of the NGO Family Frontiers there. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We will be back with more. Stay tuned. Watching Consider This. Thanks for staying with me. I'm Melissa Idris. Joining us now is one of the mothers affected by Malaysia's discriminatory citizenship laws. Patricia Lowe is a freelance writer and mother of two children born in Dublin, where they were based for her husband's work. Now, the family returned to Malaysia in 2017. She joins us on the show now. Patricia, can you begin our conversation today by maybe sharing a little bit about your story? What has been your family's experience in dealing with Malaysia's gender discriminatory citizenship laws?
Thank you very much for having me and for this opportunity to share. So it's been quite a ride since we came back, and not in a very good way. We discovered the gender discriminatory citizenship laws when we first moved back, and it has been years of frequent immigration trips that are time consuming, stressful, and especially magnified during the pandemic. Now my son is 8 years old. And he needs a student pass to live here, because once a child turns 7, this pass is their only means of remaining here and living in the country. But this ties the child to the school and not to the parent. And he is only allowed to live here as a student of a school. We faced many difficulties getting this pass due to COVID restrictions, but also because of the process, which is quite burdensome. But they have introduced even more restrictions, even more requirements at the start of this year. Now, the issue is once they age out of the student pass, which is typically after they graduate from university, if they choose to study locally, is that after that, they have no viable means to stay on in this country. They go back on a tourist visa, and options like PR or resident pass are both quite equally elusive and hard to get, with long waiting times and high rejection rates. So the situation for us mothers here who have returned, they've made Malaysia a home and brought our kids back, our family back, is that once they grow up, after growing up here in Malaysia, they face the very real risk of having to leave the country. And this is something that has already happened to other families, and it is happening even right now. So one of the mothers, the late Sabina, who very recently passed away, she had her family broken up, with the exception of her youngest daughter. When the time came, they all had to leave the country one by one. And this is the fear that we have as mothers, who, especially those of us who have returned here to Malaysia, there is no future for our children. There's a risk, you know, they can't remain.
All right. Patricia, can I ask you, what does your son understand about the situation? Is he aware of the precarious nature of his future now, you know, in the balance because of just documentation, piece of paper that says he is a Malaysian citizen?
That's a very good question. Now, he is only 8, so there's just so much that he can understand that's age appropriate for him to understand. He does realize, he does know that he is not a Malaysian. Because he knows that in order to stay here, we have to go to the immigration at least once a year to get this stamp on his passport. When he was younger, he did get episodes of fear, where suddenly he would realize, is my stamp in the passport still valid? You know, is it time to go to the immigration again? And the last time he went there, it was in February this year. And at the end of it, he said, "Mommy, I don't want to come back here anymore. I don't want to go through this again," because we had been there the whole day. Mm-hmm. And I think we only left about close to about 3 p.m., 4 p.m., and we have been there since morning. So he knows the difficulty. Whether he truly understands, no, he doesn't understand the whole scope of it and how it will affect his life and his future. That he doesn't understand yet. And I think we try to shield him as much as possible, because we also want him to be able to, you know, live in this country and to not face difficulties accepting it as his own, because it is his country. His mother's Malaysian, right? And we are here now, and we live here.
Patricia, I mean, there have been some few, but there have been some success stories, you know, of receiving citizenship and documentation. Does that give you hope, or is it a double-edged sword? Does it even hurt even more because the process has been so long and difficult for you and your family?
Yes, it definitely gave us hope when the 6 plaintiffs in the case, they received the citizenship documents. It gave me hope, because by logic, if it has already been given, the process should follow with the rest. However, as we all know, that is not the case. So that was quite disappointing. It's also quite concerning and quite worrying, because the High Court order explicitly states that it applies to all other women in similar circumstances. So that's me and a whole lot of other mothers who have already submitted the application under this High Court order. But none of us have yet to hear any good news. And it's worrying, yeah.
You understand, is it about just a lack of feedback or notification or a response, or is it the process itself that is confusing and difficult?
Now, the process itself is confusing and difficult. There is a lack of consistency, as we can understand it. Different mothers are told different things. The process and the documents required at different JPN branches or overseas missions, they differ. So there is a lack of consistency, a whole lot of confusion. And also there are documents that some mothers have found difficulty getting, such as certification from embassies. Not all embassies in the country are able to perform it. So some of them have had to fly out or get documents couriered from abroad. Yeah.
Patricia, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight. We appreciate you sharing your story. That was Patricia Low. She's a Malaysian mother fighting to confer her citizenship on her children born overseas. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for this evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.